This is First Draft on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. Just with writing, not everything from an interview makes it into the final show, so here are some outtakes from this First Draft. My guest was Elisa Chappell, author of the short story collection, Blueprints for Building Better Girls. You know, I know early in your career you worked at the Paris Review, and I'm wondering what you learned about writing and editing and the writing life when you were there.
Well, George Plimpton is a masterful editor. I mean, just he's an incredible editor, legendary editor. And so I learned a huge amount about what can come out of a story and how to rearrange a story by watching him. It was so interesting to me to see the way that he worked. He had this great little desk and a upright, old-fashioned typewriter, and he would sit there and pore over these stories and just scribble all over them, and then he would lay them all out on this pool table, which was in the apartment because we were working a lot in the apartment. And by laying out the work like that and looking at it on the pool table, he could really see the structure of the piece, and that was a great thing for me to learn how to do. I now lay my work out on the floor and look at it like that because you can kind of read it like a tapestry. But also just to see how much can come out of a story was a revelation for me. And that really a story isn't done until there's nothing left you can take out of it. He also, I remember talking to me about how you should never embarrass your reader. So you need to, like, if you're going to use a cute little name for somebody or if you're going to use language that might be a little cloying or ridiculous, make sure that you're using it sparingly because you don't want the reader to just start to feel embarrassed. And I think what he was saying, too, is embarrassed for the reader to be reading it and thinking, oh, dear, you know, this language feels overly familiar or, oh, this isn't very artful. So I certainly learned that from him.
Was there anything that you saw when all these writers were submitting their work or if you got to meet them about the life of a writer that turned you on or scared you or excited you?
Well, certainly going to all those Paris Review parties, you see that a lot of writers have some serious substance control problems. There were a number of times when very famous writers had to be carried out of the party. So I was very aware of that. I was also aware, again, getting back to how hard writing is or what a practice it is, that the way that a piece came in, you know, a story would come in by a famous writer, we would read it, and then George or one of the other editors would sit down to work on it. How much work can still be done on a piece of writing that everybody thinks is finished or is really top-notch. So I became very aware of that, how much work actually needs to be done. And what separates writers from other people, especially big writers, is that they write. They write all the time. So I certainly learned that. And I did some interviews while I was there, and one of them was with Toni Morrison. And it was incredible to sit down and talk to her about writing because she really was so fiercely committed to her voice and just so serious, unapologetic about her passion and again about, you know, I call it a practice, but I do think it is a practice.
As an editor, because you co-founded Tin House and you do some editing for Vanity Fair too, right?
Well, I write Vanity Fair's book column. And considering how small the page has become, it takes a lot of editing to get it down to a postage stamp size column. But I do. I teach in the MFA program at Columbia, so I am very used to editing work there. And it's just something that it's funny. It's very easy for me to edit other people's work to see the problems or what I perceive to be the problems in another. In another person's story, it's much harder for me to see them in my own work. And in fact, oftentimes the stuff that I'm recognizing in another person's writing, these are exactly the same mistakes I'm making in my own, or the same challenges, rather, let's be kind, that I'm facing in my own work.
When you do accept something, though, that you know you want to edit or you have ideas for, Is it sort of the sensibility of the piece that just moves you so much to take it, even though you want to do some edits?
Oftentimes what it is, Tin House, and this is something that the editor, Rob Spillman, feels very passionate about, it's the voice. How strong is the voice? How original is the voice? Sometimes if it's a theme issue, obviously, there are things that we would accept that aren't perfect, but they really fit the theme, and we know it's going to take a good amount of work. But a lot of it is, how original is it? How smart is it? That's really what I think sells it, is that originality, that voice, that vision, which is really what you're looking for in all writing, right? I mean, that's what you want. You want to read something that you haven't read before. You want to be shown a side of the world that is unfamiliar to you. And writers who are able to do that, writers who are able to present work that isn't all received knowledge, that feels like it's been created through some kind of conjuring, those are the superstars.
Well, one of the things that always fascinates me, and you were mentioning this at the Paris Review, and I'm sure it happens at Tin House, is you get a piece from a writer and you accept it, but then there's so much editing to do. And I think young writers out there might think, you know, this has to be perfect. And it does have to be perfect, I guess, in the writer's eyes. But if a piece needs a lot of editing, what is it about it that still makes you say, yes, I'm going to accept this piece?
Well, that's a very good question. And it's something I think we talk about and struggle with a lot. First of all, the when to let a piece go and when to send something out for consideration. It's funny because I think now in the age of the internet, people are sending out work too soon. They're sending it out when they feel like, well, there's nothing I can do with it right now. I'll send it out and get some other eyes on it. And I always feel a little bit insulted by that when a writer sends something out. And sometimes they'll even say in the letter, I know the beginning isn't right, but. And I always think a piece of writing can always be improved by ripping off the first page of an early draft. And if this is an early draft that you're sending me and you think it's not starting in the right place, get rid of this first page. And yes, there is a lot of editing that goes on. And the people that resist the editing the most are those writers who are new writers. They're the ones that will fight over a line or will disagree about something vehemently. Meanwhile, those people who are professional, who've done this a lot, are much more open and willing to talk about edits and to be open to changes. I remember in the first issue, we have a story by David Foster Wallace, and the story was one that it was really far along. I think he was getting ready to go into a book, and the copy editor had a bunch of questions, and he was on the phone with the copy editor for an hour, debating a semicolon and thrilled to debate a semicolon. So in my mind and in my experience, writers who are really great writers know that an editor can find stuff that they haven't seen, and they're really willing to make changes.
What do you think the role is, though, when the reader does enter of empathy in the reader-writer relationship?
Well, I think that always you want the act of reading to be a collaboration. You want the reader to be reading and not simply coming up with pictures in their mind, but you want them to be thinking, okay, well, what's going to come next? And do I want this character to get what they want? And whose side am I on? And so continually be engaging, not just on the level of curiosity, but on an intellectual level and an emotional level. And a soul level. And so there is the concern, or I do, once I've got a good solid draft, is my reader going to be engaged with this at all? How to engage them? And I think part of the way that you engage them is by creating a world and characters they simply can't resist. Without that, and that comes from creating a world that hopefully feels incredibly authentic. And for me, there is no authenticity unless you're writing from a place that feels really true for you. I feel, you know, I say this all the time to my poor students, I'm not interested in reading anything unless there's some bloody fingerprints on the page, by which I mean your fingerprints, nobody else's fingerprints, nobody else's blood. You're not allowed to sell anybody else out, but you have to sell yourself out a little bit, I think, all the time, because readers, that's what readers are reading for. They're reading to feel something and to be moved, and yes, maybe to be entertained, but you want to give them an experience. You don't want to be explaining the world to them. You want to be giving them an experience, and I don't believe that you can really do that if you're thinking about anything other than the world you're creating.